This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
They're coming to take me away, ha-ha. They're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha. To the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time. And I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha.
Well, we in fact do not know whether Donald J. Trump would be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats as they're coming to take him away. But we have noticed that the public seems to be paying somewhat better attention to the fact that this man opens his mouth and out comes crazy stuff. I mean, this is not new. This is by no means new. It's been that way all along. But at this point, it just seems a bit crazier. Didn't we air that clip a week or two ago, Mr. McMillan, about him deciding he would take the electrocution from the battery versus facing the sharks?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I don't profess to be a political expert, but I do think that if in years past at a national convention the candidate had gone up to start talking about stuff like that, they would have either cut away or the commentators would have felt the need to say something about it. And yes, we're still in a state of shock that Trump debated Biden in June and said just outlandishly crazy things like, you know, according to Roe v. Wade, you could just pull the baby out in the ninth month. Which is like, it's got the opposite of what's in Roe v. Wade. Anyway, we confess to not necessarily being huge fans of Kamala Harris. But you know what? Kamala Harris is what stands between us and a second Trump White House. Which kind of reminds me of what John F. Kennedy once said back in the 1960 race. I don't know, one of his aides or newsmen, I forget who he said it to, but he just said, "You don't understand the burden I bear. I'm the only thing standing between Nixon and the White House." Anyway, we mentioned how it is on YouTube. There's some great work being done by people that are showing you what it was that Donald J. Trump just said at this or that rally, and it's worth paying attention to the sheer nutsness of some of it. And in fact, Mr. Miller, let's take a little 3 or 4 minute detour into the latest from Dave Pakman, taking a look at exactly what we're describing.
Donald Trump gave a speech in St. Cloud, Minnesota. The speech is indoors, which now will be the trend for Trump after the failed assassination attempt. And I want you to listen to the silence of the crowd, not the silence of the lamb, as Trump often talks about during these rallies. Listen to how quiet the crowd is as Trump trashes Kamala Harris as not smart.
And now we're replacing him with worse than he is, a dangerous person who's not smart. You know she couldn't pass a law exam, right? Have you heard that? These are minor details. She couldn't pass a bar exam. She took the bar exam. She couldn't pass it. She thought she'd never be able to pass it. This is what we have wanting to be our president. Other than that, she's a very fine woman. I'd like to make that statement.
And of course, nothing strikes man of the people more than making fun of someone because it took them 2 tries to pass the bar exam. And meanwhile, Trump University's an overt scam, as if Trump knows anything about education. Speaking about education and destroying public education, Trump again saying he won't give any money to schools with vaccine mandates.
And I will not give one penny to any school that has a vaccine mandate or a mask mandate.
And the crowd goes wild. That's every public school. Every public school has vaccine requirements. You know who rejoiced? In addition to the people in this room in St. Cloud, Minnesota, polio rejoiced. Measles threw a party after hearing what Donald Trump said. Now, of course, there's 2 parts to this. There's the medical, which is there are diseases that we have successfully dealt with thanks to vaccines. And if we were to get rid of that, it would be a medical disaster. In addition to that, bye-bye to public education if indeed all federal government funding to any school with a vaccine mandate stopped, because every school has vaccine requirements. Now you might say, oh, David, that would be terrible. It would destroy public education. That's right. they want to destroy public education. That's part of the additional benefit of attacking vaccines in this way. Seemingly with no sense for satire, Trump says criminals will always be criminals.
A criminal is a criminal, and they generally stay a criminal, and we don't have time to figure it out.
Right. Of course, we should apply that to Trump. And it's always, well, no, but I'm not really a criminal. It's just that I was unfairly railroaded by the Biden Justice Department and a Trump-hating judge and a Trump-hating jury and Trump-hating prosecutors who lied and did this and then that, and then they got... Right. Just listen to what he's saying. Criminals tend to stay criminals. There's one criminal running, and it's Donald Trump. Pretty hard to argue with. Pretty hard to argue with. Revitalizing old rants, Trump also brought up Hunter Biden. And he asked the crowd, remember when I used to talk about Hunter Biden?
Where's Hunter? Remember the sign we did, where's Hunter? That became, remember that one? I said, where's Hunter? The next day my people were doing shirts, where's Hunter? That was the big one.
Yeah, remember the good old days where I would, you know, talk about Hunter Biden? Wasn't that cool? Also still on the Kamala Harris's laugh is a problem train.
Margaret Thatcher didn't laugh like that, did she? Did she laugh? If she did, she wouldn't have been Margaret Thatcher. It's very simple.
As an absolutely rabid, failed attempt to criticize Kamala Harris, the laugh stuff really isn't working. And then finally, here you see as Trump is still speaking, lots of people filing out, just people everywhere, slowly heading for the exits in every single one of the, you know, the stairs in between the various sections of seating. So not exactly a powerful speech.
He's describing at the end people getting up and leaving the convention center as he was rambling on incoherently. And, well, we hope that's the beginning of a larger trend. We ourselves are going to return to our favorite Trump expert, Stephen J. Harper, adjunct professor of law at Northwestern University, who has just done a fantastic job for us and for the public in his writing about, well, the mishaps of Donald J. Trump. He has talked about Trump's behavior regarding COVID, his behavior regarding Ukraine, the whole Trump-Russia thing, and a lot more. And to round out this first segment today, we're going to use an audio clip from a Young Turks interview with Mr. Joe Connison. We think we can probably get Joe Connison for this program, but we did not do so for today's show. So we will air a clip wherein he talks about his new book titled The Longest Con. Its subtitle is How Grifters, Swindlers, and Frauds Hijacked American Conservatism. Connison knows a thing or two about this. Back in 2003, he wrote a book titled Big Lies, The Right-Wing Propaganda Machine and How It Distorts the Truth. Well, spoiler alert, it hasn't gotten better between the two books. I heard Connison being interviewed on a local Bay Area station. Might have been KALW 91.7, I'm not sure, but he came across very well talking about this book, The Longest Con. So I ordered myself a copy, and I am suitably impressed with his looking back and putting together some of the details of how there's been this alliance of the uber wealthy, the political fixers, and right-wing Christian fundamentalists, which started out half a century ago or more, and believe you me, is still very much with us in the current things we're seeing in the national political landscape. Well, we don't want today to be all doom and gloom, so let's do what we like to do, which is do some current events, and what better way to start that than with the good, the bad, and the ugly. We are indebted today to The Week magazine for these selections. They note that it was a good week last week for acronyms after Senator Gary Peters, Democrat of Michigan, introduced a bill that would bar federal agencies from disqualifying job applicants because of marijuana use. Yay. And I guess that all sounds good and well. The bill, you should know, is titled the Dismantling Outdated Obstacles and Barriers to Individual Employment Act, better known as DOOBIE. Yes, the DOOBIE Act. We'll see how that fares. It was conversely a bad week for fans of the Country Bear musical Jamboree, the popular attraction since 1971 at Disney's Magic Kingdom's theme park in Florida, and I think before that in Disneyland. Anyway, here's the story. It reopened last week without Liverlips McGrawl. Yes, apparently this animatronic bear was deemed potentially offensive to alcoholics. You see, the term liver lips is associated with excessive alcohol consumption, something I confess I did not know. The people at Disney added in a blog post that the company is committed to rectifying outdated or culturally insensitive elements within its attractions. Now, Ms. McMillan wonders whether there'll be some pushback on this for people who feel that, you know, the alcoholics of the world, particularly the alcoholic animatronic bears of the world, may be discriminated against for suspected alcohol abuse. And I guess there, too, we'll have to see how this breaks. And finally, it was an ugly week last week for, I guess you'd say, political unions, with the news that the gay male dating app Grindr crashed last week, reportedly because of a sudden surge in traffic in Milwaukee during the Republican National Convention. This prompted former GOP Representative George Santos to say, "Just come out of the closet, boys. It's fun." I tell you, one of the most shocking things I found about Joe Connison's book was the number of prominent political activists who actively worked against gay rights who were, in fact, closeted homosexuals. This does remind me of one of the more interesting interviews we've conducted over the past decades. This was with Henry W. Vinson about his book, Confessions of a DC Madam, subtitled The Politics of Sex, Lies, and Blackmail. Mr. Vinson was himself a male prostitute and, quote, madam, unquote. If you did not hear that interview when it aired, we suggest, dear listener, you go to our archives at radioparallax.com. Check it out. Well, the good and the bad and the ugly is hardly a comprehensive summary of current events, but I need to tell you about Joe Connison's book a little bit before we go to our clip, so we'll do more current events on next week's show. And we should tell you that Joe Connison is an American journalist and commentator. He is editor-in-chief of The National Memo, a daily political newsletter, and a senior fellow at Type Media Center. His articles have appeared in many publications around the world, including The New Republic, The Nation, The Guardian, Salon, and The Village Voice. Two of his prior books, The Hunting of the President and Big Lies, were New York Times bestsellers. The book starts out with what Connison calls the role model. In this case, he's referring to Roy Cohn. Back in April of 1953, Roy Marcus Cohn, who was counsel to Senator Joseph McCarthy's Communist Hunting Subcommittee back in Washington, D.C., embarked upon a tour investigating supposed suspect literature held in U.S. Information Service libraries. A lot of what we see today in politics really does date back to the antics of Roy Cohn, including Donald J. Trump. We mentioned that movie, The Apprentice, which has been out now for some time, but is having difficulty finding an American distributor, tells the story of how Roy Cohn mentored young Donald Trump to become what he became. Connison even includes a quote from Trump about Roy Cohn, in which he says, "I don't kid myself about Roy. He was no Boy Scout. He once told me he'd spent more than two-thirds of his adult life under indictment on one charge or another. I said to him, 'Roy, just tell me one thing. Did you really do all that stuff?' He looked at me and smiled. 'What the hell do you think?' he said." To which Trump, or his ghostwriter, adds, "I never really knew," which I think is disingenuous. Anyway, the Young Turks program had an interview with Connison recently talking about the longest con. And I think, Mr. McMillan, let's just play an excerpt from it, shall we?
Republican side's a little bit more complicated. They've always served the rich and corporations. But then there's the religious right. There's a lot of folks in there with different agendas. So talk to us about those different agendas and who the different camps are.
Well, as you noted, there is definitely a sort of a dominant class of billionaires who are at the top and who are Trump's. Some of them are Trump's personal friends. Some of them are just, you know, people who I guess Trump sucks up to and admires for their great wealth, which he pretends to have, but mostly has not had. So that's one sort of dominant force. And it's the reason why in every Republican administration, cutting taxes for the, you know, 1% or even a smaller group is the core policy. It is the top priority always and forever. Then there are, as you said, other factions. There's a strong faction that's existed on the religious right, at least since the days of Reagan, which I discuss in the book, how that came about. And that came about in some degree as a grift as well, sponsored by Richard Viguerie, who went to Jerry Falwell and said we could raise a lot of money if we can only organize evangelical parishes into a political movement. And they did, and they did that and created the Moral Majority, and which later spawned various imitators like the Christian Coalition under Pat Robertson and so on. And their agenda is, you know, well, so one of the things I talk about in the book is that originally their agenda was defending segregated Christian academies. It really had nothing to do with abortion. Excuse me. They try to pretend that abortion was the motivating force behind the Christian right. But actually, when the religious right began in the mid-1970s, the Southern Baptist Convention had endorsed abortion rights, so in its own platform. So there's a myth there that deserves to be exploded, and a lot of it was about race and segregation for them. Falwell had his own segregated Christian academy, so that's another like big force within the Republican Party, and overlapping with, you know, supposed religious concerns. Concerns about morality, supposedly, although with Trump, it's hard to give much credit to that anymore. And race, as you know, is a major motivating factor for the right in this country and always has been. And there are other, you know, factions as well. I mean, there's now sort of a tech faction led by people like Peter Thiel, who want as little government as possible. They want they almost like to have, you know, their own sovereignty and escape any government regulation of the tech industry, which really kind of, in my view, needs a lot more regulation than it has gotten, especially with AI developing and the rest. So these are all sort of factions within the modern Republican Party. But what they all do is grift. They all have their own forms of grift. And it has, appeared through in different forms in the religious right, what's called the prosperity gospel, in the Tea Party, which was full of grifters, that movement competing with each other and fighting, which is a kind of a funny part of the book. And I examine all of these grifts and scams in the book and try to explain how they come together and how Trump represents a kind of an amazing sort of apotheosis of this tendency on the right, which has only become stronger and stronger since the 1950s, when it took the form of anti-communism and paranoia about an imminent communist takeover of the United States. And the only way you could stop that was to send money to these various anti-communist advocates and organizations.
Yeah. So, Joe, I want to take one part of that faction, the Christian nationalists. So here's my question about them. Is it that they, I'm not talking about the flock, because the flock is always misled, right? I'm talking about their leaders. Is it that they think, yeah, this is obviously so the rich can get tax cuts, so we'll trick our own followers into pretending that it's about religion when we don't care about that at all, right? Or is it that they're doing that same trick, but they don't care about the rich overall? They're not part of the Chamber of Commerce, Republicans, etc. They're just worried about their own grift. They think, oh, if I get people riled up, yeah, they'll vote Republican, but they'll also give money to my church, and that's what I mainly care about.
Well, the interesting thing about that, Cenk, is that in my book, I describe how these prosperity gospel preachers who become, many of whom have become millionaires or multimillionaires, some of whom are very close to Trump, like Paula White and Kenneth Copeland, they don't get taxed. I mean, they really have it sweet. They have it set up so that as supposed religious institutions, their businesses don't get taxed. So I don't know if they are worried about the tax cuts that other wealthy malefactors are, you know, pursuing. But I do think they see their interests as aligned because they too want to avoid government regulation. You know, at one point, as I describe in the book, Senator Pressler actually became so appalled by the depredations of these prosperity gospel preachers that he opened an investigation in the Senate. And of course, they moved very quickly to get that shut down and stopped. And they escaped any kind of sanction or real investigation. They just refused to cooperate. And of course, Pressler, being himself, he folded and went away. And that was the end of that. They see themselves as a constituency of the Republican Party, and they're very much aligned with right-wing ideology.
Yeah. Joe, you have as a subtitle in your book, Hijacked American Conservatism. But is that a—
I knew you were going to argue with that, Cenk.
Yeah. Is that a thing? Is that real? Or is that just a mirage? Was there ever American conservatism?
I think there was. I mean, I think someone like John McCain was a genuine conservative. He went through periods when he was less genuine, perhaps, but I think he was a real conservative. I think the guy who wrote the foreword to my book, George Conway, who's somebody who I opposed, quite vehemently in the past, and exposed some of his activities in the New York Observer when I worked there. Now, as somebody I consider a friend, I think he's a real honest conservative. I think, Liz Cheney is a real conservative, which is why they'd like to execute her on TV now. I mean, this is the real conservatism at one time provided a kind of guardrail in our society against possible excesses of liberalism. And maybe some people may think there's no such thing as an excess. I don't think there was a huge amount of excess, but, it's good to have a debate over how to run a society and what you do for people and what you ask of people in return. That's a worthwhile philosophical debate, but we don't have it anymore because there's no organized institution of real conservatives anymore.
Yeah.
That was the Republican Party, but you're absolutely right that if it ever did exist, it does not exist now.
Let me turn to the final thought here. Okay, so you read your book and you see it's like it's a horror show, right? The Republican Party when you lift a veil. And you see,
I tried to put some jokes in. I mean,
I hear you. But I'm just saying, you see all these grifters, right, from religious leaders ripping off religious followers, so-called conservatives ripping off actual conservative voters, etc. But yet the Democrats can't seem to expose them. And they keep losing to hucksters, like obvious hucksters like Donald Trump. They lost in 2016, they're about to lose in 2024. So as I look at it, I go, what the hell's wrong with the Democratic Party? Why can't they beat this when it's so obvious?
Well, I mean, did they lose in 2016? She won the popular vote by quite a bit, Hillary Clinton. So they didn't, if we had a better electoral system, they wouldn't lose to someone like Trump, I think almost ever. Biden beat him by a lot in 2020. So I don't think you could say they just keep losing all the time. I do think I agree with you that it would do them a lot of good to read this book and take a hard look at how corrupt the Republican and conservative movements are, Republican Party and conservative movement, and how they've ripped off their own people and try to you know, let people know about that. Force the right to defend the ripoffs that it's perpetrated on its own people. That, I think, would be a useful exercise for them. And it would show a certain toughness that is very much needed. That there, I think we agree.
Yeah, so I'm, of course, a lot tougher on the Democratic Party than, well, first of all, than almost anyone on the left. But look, here's my theory on why they don't expose the corruption of the Republican Party, which is overwhelming. It's because they're also corrupt. They're corrupt in a different way, but they take donor money and do exactly what the donors tell them to do. So that's why they don't talk about the Republican corruption and give up their largest political advantage that they would have if they brought that up. What do you think of that?
Well, I would say, first of all, I think you know that not all Democrats are the same. And so some, I think there would be some Democrats that would fit your description and many others who wouldn't. But, you know, if I write about a book about the Democratic Party, maybe I would find that there was, you know, some of what you're talking about. I've certainly exposed Democrats in the past. When I started working at the Village Voice years ago in New York City, it's a Democratic city, and you know, the corrupt people that you found were Democrats, also a lot of the good people, because there basically weren't any Republicans. But you know, I don't think they're the same. I think if you go through the book, and it sounds to me like you've read quite a bit of it, I think I would challenge you to make any comparable, find any comparable things that Democrats or people on the left have done to these ripoffs, which are so rampant on the right. There's just nothing like it on the left. You know, there's a reason why, for instance, that the small dollar donors and the Republican Party give to a thing called WinRed. And WinRed is a private profit-making company. And, you know, as you know very well, on the other side, on the left side, those who want to give to Democratic candidates give through Act Blue, small donors, which is a nonprofit and doesn't rip off people in any way. There's never been a scandal attached to it. And WinRed is jacking up prices. Even the Republicans say, you know, what are we doing here? And this has happened over and over again, Cenk. In my book, most of the people that I quote about the corruption of the Republicans are Republicans, are other Republicans who have looked at this. People like Jim Garrity at the National Review and Eric Erickson of Red State, many others who've looked across this landscape of eluding by so-called conservatives, and they're disgusted by it. And there's a reason for that.
Anyway, pretty interesting stuff. And, you know, in this little clip or two that we just aired, it just scratches the surface. We probably would do well to try and bring Mr. Joe Connison on this program and, you know, turn him loose for an hour. But right now, we should take a short break. You're listening to Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett. Stick around. In the on-deck circle, we have Stephen J. Harper, and he's always good.